Immigration Officer to say a few words of introduction.
Thank you, Monica Plaza. Of course, I repeat this welcome. Physics Institute of Mathematical Sciences, also known as PIMS, extends a cordial welcome to all of you, and we're very happy that you are so numerous. Today we are going to talk about something very serious. I think the stress is going to be on algebra. And as you know, it was invented by some bloke called Al-Khwarizmi in Baghdad. And I'm happy to say this today because we all know where it is. this was a long time ago in the caliphate of Mamun al-Rashid. When the crusaders came down there, they also discovered, to their great amazement, that they had hospitals where people were actually expected to come out alive. In Europe, they only had hospices. Now, the hospitals have caught on very well in the European culture and in the North American one, we all know, but algebra is still lagging behind. The Mathematical Association of Germany, just like all mathematics, let's say the German Mathematical Society, okay, has an organ called notices, like Canadian and American. And in those notices recently, somebody said, officially, one of the editors reported from San Francisco that he'd seen a T-shirt which said, "Why do I need algebra for a career in pornography?" We're trying to answer that today.
It's my really great pleasure to welcome our first speaker of the day, Bernice Kastner, a longtime friend and a person probably solely responsible by my working at Simon Fraser. Because of her travels, I was first asked to replace her. There it was. Bernice got her undergraduate degree at McGill University, and then her MA in Education at Syracuse University, and PhD in the University of Maryland. And I remember some time ago, Bernice told me a story, like she wanted to choose an honors program in mathematics and physics. And she was called to the dean and said, "Well, are you sure you want to do this? Would you rather keep the place free for one of your male colleagues who would make a real use of this?" So, fortunately for me, for us, and for many, many people, she said, "No, I want to do this." And she did. Now, she has teaching experience from intermediate grades through university, including several years at Simon Fraser University, both in the Department of Mathematics, where we met, and in the Faculty of Education. She wrote several books. Amongst others, she was a person, one of the team who prepared the first NCTM document in, there are two. I see here is that Applications of Secondary School Mathematics, NCTM 1978, and then NCTM 79 Yearbook Application in School Mathematics. But then she was involved with NCTM for many years afterwards, as well as with Mathematical Association of America. And recently, she was involved in the project at Rochester Institute of Technology to improve mathematical placement testing for incoming students in calculus. And we started to talk about it sometime in the fall. And I thought it would be great if she would come and share her experiences with us. So please join us.
Well, actually, it was even worse than what Margarita told you about how I took honors mathematics and physics at McGill, because I was invited into the office of the chair of the department, who said, "We're not going to let you do this." And fortunately, I was stubborn. I didn't argue with him. I just waited for them to kick me out, and they couldn't find an excuse to do it, so I did it. Okay, well, I promised to talk today about algebra, as the language of mathematics. And I'm going to start by giving you a little bit of background. Wait, let me just put this on here. I'll use the other one to write on. And maybe before I go into this background, I should elaborate a little bit on my own background in terms of teaching mathematics at all these levels. Yes? Okay, so I was going to tell you a little bit more about my own background, because before I came to SFU, I spent most of my teaching, I had my 3 years of teaching in the middle school, grades 7 through 9. And then I taught at a community college, and I had also taught at the University of Maryland as a graduate student, working with a course for prospective elementary school teachers. After I left SFU, when I went back to Maryland, I spent the rest of my career in teacher preparation. And so gradually, between the University of Maryland and Towson University, where I was until I retired, they worked me down from secondary methods to elementary methods, and I ended up teaching the early childhood methods classes, for which I was prepared by the fact that when my son was in preschool, every time I was helping mother, it was a cooperative preschool, every time I was helping mother, the teacher would bring out all the Montessori materials, because she said I could answer the children's questions better than she could. And that was very enlightening, that experience, because one of the things I discovered was, it's one thing to know something. It's one thing to know the answers. It's quite something else to provide the young child with an answer that makes sense to them. So this was, that was my preparation for doing early childhood methods. So I will come back to my experiences in that regard, because this bears very heavily on the whole business of how we teach algebra, what algebra is all about, and so on. Okay, but I'm going to begin by telling you a little bit about the placement testing program that we are that we're engaged in at the Rochester Institute of Technology. We are changing from a placement testing that was done just before classes started in the fall and caused a great deal of confusion, of administrative confusion, to online testing. And of course, the reason they're doing placement testing is because of the same problem that everybody else complains about, is that students are entering the university not properly prepared to take calculus. Now, as far as most college people are concerned, I don't know, everybody seems to think that has something to do with what they're doing at high school these days. I have a more jaded view, because I think it was ever thus. Maybe we're getting more people coming to college to take calculus, and maybe that's why we're seeing more of them who are unprepared, but I did put in placement testing at Montgomery College before I came to Vancouver back in the 1970s when we had a project to provide help to students. So I don't see this as a new problem at all, other than maybe the fact that we have more of these people. So I looked at the tests that we're giving, and these are the most common weaknesses that we have. I mean, to pick out the questions where students actually have the most trouble, they are, the three I've listed here are the worst. You'll notice all of them involve fractions. Okay? Now, let's see if I can, I guess they're, I'll move this a little bit there. So there is an example of a literal equation that is probably one of the worst performance items on the test. Okay? Maybe what I should do is just put the others here. Here are some more examples. Now, you might be interested to know, in the simplify problem, there are fully as many people who have trouble with that minus sign as with the exponents. Okay, in other words, this is a multiple choice test. And the response for p to the fourth is a commonly chosen. It's probably the most popular answer. So when they choose that, you know the problem is that they don't know what to do with that squared as it refers to the minus sign, right? They know that the cube root of negative 8 is negative 2, and then when they square it, they're not sure whether they're squaring minus 2 or whether they're squaring 2. Okay, so it's an order of operations problem. That's all it is. That's the most common. And, of course, the fraction one. And, of course, I couldn't resist putting on here the other common thing. Everything distributes. And I realized that the other thing I should have put on here was what my kids in middle school used to do, and they're the same people who want to do this. Because I had the experience twice in my career, because I taught at the middle school for a short period. Then I went on to graduate school. Then I decided I really preferred teaching middle school better, and I went back for a year, and they drove me out because I didn't have time to do the job to my own satisfaction. However, I twice had the experience of seeing kids that I had taught in grades 7, 8, or 9 appearing at the university. And it was an interesting experience. This is the other thing they want to distribute. You know the area formula for a triangle. So if they measure something or if they're given numbers and they end up having to do 1/2 base times height, well, this I didn't mean to have a decimal point in it, they will say that's 3 times 4 because the half has to distribute. Everything has to distribute, okay? So these are the sorts of weaknesses that we're dealing with, okay? Now, before I go to what I really want to talk about, let's look at the question of what is algebra, because it's lots of things. Okay, and the first four things I've listed here, it's generalized arithmetic, where we take the arithmetic processes and we express them symbolically. A study of procedures, you know, algebra, as was referred to, the Arabic word that we get algebra from means to transpose, move it to the other side, I mean, one of the processes. It's also a study of relationships among quantities. I mean, the function ideas and so on come out in that. Structures, that's what we call abstract algebra. And then the first four are as listed by Zalman Yuziskin in a paper he wrote about 8 years ago about algebra. And the last one was the subtitle of a conference that the National Science Foundation sponsored. And so when I agreed to do this talk, I thought that that was what I was going to focus on. I'm not sure that I really am going to end up with that. But I thought, well, let me see where I go. So maybe we'll talk a little bit about languages, because I think it's important for us to realize the parallels. The characteristics of language. There are certain things about it that are arbitrary. Why do we use certain words to mean certain things? Well, it just grew up that way, right? We do the same thing in mathematics. Some of the words that we use and some of the symbols that we use are, you know, nobody would figure them out except the way we figure out language by being immersed in it, right? How do we learn language in the first place when we're young? We're simply immersed in it and our brain sorts it out and we learn, oh, that's what these things mean. So the social aspects are the ones that somebody has to tell you in some form, maybe by just you hearing it repeatedly, okay? The logical aspects, well, that would be the grammar. Now, I remember attending a talk here by John Mason of the Open University, and he did a wonderful job of demonstrating how quickly we generalize. The human brain generalizes. And it was at a previous meeting where I'd heard him speak where he made the statement that every mistake is the result of a brilliant generalization based on insufficient experience. And what I really want to focus on here is the kind of experiences we provide for children when they are learning arithmetic, when they are learning geometry, when they are learning algebra. We don't give them enough experience, and then they generalize. They're going to generalize. Their brain tells them to generalize, and they're going to generalize incorrectly. Now, the other thing, when I do my methods courses, I talk about learning, you know, the three ways of learning, and not only do we have the arbitrary and the logical, but, you know, this is the logical-mathematical approach, and everybody figures. Everybody has some kind of logic in their head. The other thing is the physical. Okay, the things you learn by manipulating things, by making observations, by looking at the physical world. And I think that a lot of our problems in teaching mathematics today can be traced to the fact that about, 150 years ago, mathematics and science became different disciplines. Until then, you look at the names that created a lot of the mathematics that we teach, these people were also physicists. And some of them were chemists. I mean, you know, there were, in other words, mathematics and science used to be interwoven. And now we've separated them. And I think one of the things we've done when we teach elementary mathematics is we've lost those connections, and we've lost the connection to the physical world. So also, language changes over time, and so does our mathematical practices. In language, you get the same word that has different meanings. Sometimes you have different words that mean the same thing. These things happen in mathematical too, and hopefully I'm going to come back to some of this. I'm going to try to keep one eye on the time. Now, the other thing that I would like to quote to you is the famous thing from Einstein, because we ignore this at our peril constantly. In mathematics, or on teaching mathematics, everything should be made as simple as possible, but no simpler. And boy, do we oversimplify. So we really mislead kids by our oversimplifications. So hopefully I'm going to give you some examples of that. Okay. Now, maybe before I turn to that, I should also show you my nice cartoon that I had my grandson make for me once, because he's a good cartoonist, about what has been the prevalent mode for teaching anything, including mathematics, right? Out of my mouth come pearls of wisdom into your head, right? I have never understood why the lecture method didn't die out with the invention of the printing press. But I have to say that I used to try to get all my students to read the text with very limited success. And partly, I think, that was a function of how the texts were written. And partly it was a function of some of the other things I want to turn my attention to. Now, I wanted to say at the beginning that please interrupt me at any point. I mean, I'm going like an express train now, and I suppose this is partly because we had the interruption and so on, and I want to get to some of the things I want to talk about. Okay. So you hear a lot of talk in the world of education these days about learning disabilities. But I like to talk about the learned disabilities. Students entering college, which is the focus of my RIT project, come with a lot of learned disabilities. And the reason they've been learned is because that's what they were taught. Okay? Now, there's a great tendency to do a lot of teacher bashing. Okay? The university people will say, oh, the high school teachers don't know enough and they can't teach it right. The high school teachers will say, oh, the elementary school teachers don't know it and they can't teach it right. What I would like to pay attention to, since I got out of public school teaching, out of middle school teaching, which I truly loved. I mean, there's nothing like a 13-year-old when you turn them on. I mean, that was probably the most exciting teaching I've ever done in my life. But what killed it for me, and the reason I got out, was because the society seems to think that the only time you're working when you're a teacher is when you're in the class with the kids. Right? And that's just the beginning, because if you don't have planning time and you don't have time to bring the work home and look at it. I mean, if you know, it's all the other things that take up all your time. And what drove me out of public school teaching was that I was not able to do the job to my own satisfaction. And so I instead went and got my doctorate in midlife, because that was easier. So, you know, it's a big problem. But here are some of the learned disabilities. And I realized after I made this, I realized that when I was looking at this on the plane coming over here, that I really want to put something in before this. Because, and I'm going to show you examples of these. But what I want to look at before I even look at the measured versus exact numbers is, you know, back in the days of the Greeks, you know, that they, you know, that the seven Greek liberal arts, four of them were mathematical, right? That we had geometry, which was magnitudes at rest. We had numbers, we had arithmetic. Arithmetic was numbers at rest. Astronomy was considered to be magnitudes in motion, and music was numbers in motion. I mean, when I learned that, I was really excited, because that's really an exciting thing to do. Now, one of the things we do now is we blur the distinction, I'll just turn this for a minute so I can write it, between magnitudes. In other words, I'll put it down here, continuous and numbers, which is a discrete. And one of the things I want to do is show you how we blur that distinction. And it comes home to roost, particularly when kids are learning fractions. I'll show you how. So, measured versus exact numbers. Let me find my slide. Here it is. Where we show kids, we introduce them to the idea of measurement. This is a page from a grade one textbook. What's the message? Every measurement is exact, right? They're using informal units. They're using paper clips on this page. And look at them. Now, when I gave a talk for teachers at a National Council of Teachers of Mathematics meeting, I handed out strings of paper clips. And I said, everybody take whatever you brought to write with and measure it with this string of paper clips. And then I asked, how many of you are happy to give me an exact whole number for an answer? Well, in a room with this many people in it, I might get three hands. And then I put this on here, and I said, well, why are these in the textbook? Now, I used to spend all my time, once I got involved with early childhood education and I looked at the textbooks, I used to spend all my time at meetings of the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics arguing with publishers' representatives about putting stuff like this in the textbook. And I got exactly nowhere. The answers I would get back are, well, should we be teaching kids fractions in grade one? And, they didn't like my answer because I said, no, why can't they say a little more than three or between five and six or, you know, an answer like that? Why don't we show them real things? And, of course, I used to tell my students, don't use these pages. You want the kids to learn to measure. Give them something to measure with. If you want, you can even give them strings of paper clips and let them measure real things because they'll never get these kinds of results. Okay? And then I have another page here. From grade two, and in grade two, look, we're still doing the same thing. Okay, and then I can't resist showing you what happens with this once they handle decimals. Here's a page from a textbook. You'll notice this is a Canadian textbook. I actually copied this page when I was here at SFU. Because it's metric. You see, that's the giveaway. Look at this. I cringe when I see things like this. You know, when the kids get to decimals, we teach them how to round. But we never teach them when to round. And we don't teach them how to round properly. I mean, as an undergraduate at McGill, between my last 2 years, I got the plum job. Of course, this is another... irony. I got that job at the National Research Council in Ottawa, And it was in the days when the only kinds of calculators we had were the old Frieden and Marchant ones with all the cams that would turn, you know. I got so I could do square roots by hand faster than those machines. I used to play beat the machines because that was such a boring part of my job. But my job was that. Now, you know why I got that job is in connection with the introduction where they didn't want me to take math and physics. The person who hired me, the guy from the National Research Council that came to interview the students, when I got the job, I almost turned it down. But it was a good job, and I decided I will pay attention to my own self-interest because he said doing calculations appeals to a woman's housekeeping instinct. But it was a very good job. Now, I would be adding up columns of figures, of course, on those machines, or doing, of course, I did other kinds of things. I did integrations with polynomials. I mean, I used five-figure logarithm tables. I mean, there were all kinds of calculations that you had to do in those days. And, of course, the slide rule was indispensable if you didn't have that many significant figures. But if you were rounding, you either round back to your least precise measurement that you can get, or if you have to do a lot of rounding, you know, kids learn this rule, and it is an absolute rule. At the place you're starting to drop digits, where you're going to truncate, if the number is less than 5, you simply truncate, you drop the others. If the number is 5 or more, you round up. Well, if you're going to do a lot of calculations and you're going to add up a lot of numbers, if the last number is a 5 and there's nothing after it, if you drop one, you know, if you drop the 5, well, if you round up on the first time because that's what you're instructed to do, the next time you see a 5, you truncate. Because otherwise you're going to have a systematic error and it's always going to be too big. Well, kids have no way of knowing anything like that today because look at how they're taught. Whatever decimals you've got, hang on to them for dear life and look at this capacity of this swimming pool. They've got it to the nearest thousandth of a meter. Heaven help us. And, I mean, here's another one. Same thing. Here's area. Now we're... Okay? So this is the sort of thing kids get in terms of exact versus measurement numbers. So every number is always exact as far as kids are concerned. There are no such things as measured numbers. If you've got a digit on your calculator, you can't draw, you know, it's magic. It's got to be there. There's so many things that this does that we don't want it to do, and I have never been able to persuade any publisher, and believe me, I've talked to a lot of them, that we have to teach kids, as soon as an issue of rounding comes up, we have to teach them how to round. And, of course, to go back to the thing I had in the first place, if they really measured things and they, instead of being taught this, it would be easy to teach about rounding. I mean, I didn't bring all the other nonsense I have about this, about appending zeros when you want to subtract with decimals. You can always append as many zeros as you like. It doesn't matter that it was a measured number. I mean, there are so many nonsense problems that we give kids. Okay, so now I'm working up to a point I want to make. By the time kids approach algebra, they have learned that, I mean, certainly they learned this in first and second grades, that the math they're being taught in school as, quote, mathematics, isn't logical because it doesn't make sense. It doesn't apply to the world. So what they have to learn is how to give the teacher the answer that the teacher is looking for, right? They psych you out. It's just like you learn a language. You learn what it means. How are people using it? You know, we used to, in the days of the new math has a bad rap, but that's partly because they went overboard. We used to, you give the kids the definition of a rectangle, which is the boundary, and then you say, and here's a model of a rectangle. And, of course, this is a nice model of a rectangular region, right? And we tell them, here's a model of a rectangle, but we've told them that, oh, heaven help us, what they told them recently, I previewed, let's do it recently, but 10 years ago I looked at some video presentation about children, and they were being taught to distinguish the different geometric shapes, and they were teaching these kindergartners to sing two long sides and two short sides. What am I? And the answer was a rectangle. And I went, I knew the guy who had produced them, and I said, what are they going to do when they get to parallelograms? And of course, we also teach them very carefully that a square is not a rectangle, because we give them four shapes. Every elementary school, every first grade textbook has this lesson. Four shapes: a circle, a square, a rectangle, and a triangle. Every triangle is equilateral. Heaven help us, the kids should learn that triangles come with different shapes, or even that rectangles come in different shapes. Because the question that they asked is this a square or a circle or a triangle or whatever the other one was that I said? And we're explicitly teaching them that a square is not a rectangle, because we're using the word or in that context. Not only that, but the teacher's answer book doesn't say under the square, well, you could use square or you could use rectangle, right? So it's not an answer that the teacher's answer book allows. So these are the sorts of things that I think create a great deal of difficulty. Okay, number lines. Where's my number line? Somewhere here I have a number line. I knew I was going to get mixed up with my transparencies because... where's the number line? Here we are. I could have just drawn one. This is just a number line. So even if we do something like show the kids early on, in first grade, we teach kids to add on a number line. Okay, so if we do them a favor, we at least don't stop it at zero, because someday they're going to hit negative numbers, and they need to know that it's going to continue on the other side. So I made my number line with at least a little space over here to show that it's not over yet. And what I should have done was this, okay, to show that it goes on. Okay, so the kids learn to add on the number line. And how do they learn to add on the number line? They focus completely on, if they want to add 2 plus 3, they'll do 1, there's 2. And now you get a lot of kids, when they have to add the 3, they're not sure. They think they're counting the numbers. Some of them will begin by counting the 2 again. But anyway, they'll do this. They're little hops. Nowhere is there any attention given to the fact that this is something continuous. That when you're adding on the number line, what you really ought to be doing is moving up little blocks, right? There's one. There's the next one. In other words, pay attention to what's in between, because you're going to get kids dealing with inequalities in algebra, and they think if they have something like, let's say, 6 less than x less than, let's say, 9, that what's in there is two numbers, 7 and 8. Right? No attention, and this is from grade 1 when they work with number lines. So... And again, I don't know what you do with this, except maybe not use the number line yet for teaching addition. Do it later when they're ready to deal with it, when you need it. I'm not sure. Let's talk about the operations. Here is the meaning of the operations that kids learn in mathematics in school. Okay? Addition means joining. Subtraction means taking away. Multiplication is repeated addition. And division is repeated subtraction. This is something I used to use when we looked at... Then we wonder why they can't do word problems. Okay, and then there are a lot of teachers who have been trained to teach by keywords. Okay, if it says less, you're subtracting. You still see this in a lot of places. Okay, here is something that was put together by a group of researchers at the University of Wisconsin... about modeling word problems. So this is for addition and subtraction. And you see that some of the same conditions, depending on what you know and what you're asking for, with the same kind of physical situation, sometimes you add and sometimes you subtract. And the beauty of this approach and of teaching the kids explicitly how to analyze the problems, and of course what they did at the University of Wisconsin when they were developing this, was they had the kids model these with physical objects. I mean, they had real marbles, or they had blocks to use for the marbles or something. And the kids very quickly were able to learn to distinguish between real-world situations where you add and real-world situations when you subtract, and the fact, heaven help us, that addition and subtraction are related, because that's going to become essential when they get to signed numbers, to realize that addition and subtraction are related to each other. And eventually, when they hit the rule, which they most kids get as a rule, that if you want to subtract, that this is the same as adding the reciprocal, they really, if they've had this experience, that can be very easy. But if they haven't had that experience, well, first of all, what do they think when they see minus b? If they see any letter with a minus sign in front of it, obviously it's negative, right? And if I have time, I'll show you some algebra textbooks where we're not making this very clear. So, of course, my algebra textbook is an old one. So, you know, these are the sorts of things that kids are experiencing. And it's very hard for them to get beyond, you know, to do the proper generalization. We want them to generalize. In fact, what all the uproar these days about kids using calculators, using graphing calculators and so on, has to do with the fact they're using these things mindlessly, right? And the reason they're using them mindlessly is because they're using it in mathematics. And in mathematics, you have to follow the rules. And if you stop to think about it, there must be something wrong with you. You know, the drive for automaticity, that kids should be able to know their number facts and say everything automatically, has unfortunately had a side effect that if you have to stop and think about it, you must not be very smart. If you can't make sense out of what the teacher is saying, you must not be very smart. So it's had a very negative effect, and what kids have learned to do is psych out how to give the right answer and turn off their minds. Because if they don't, they're too confused. You know, I in one of my methods classes, I had a teacher who protested when I told her that we had to show kids just how complicated some of these things are. She said, "Aren't we going to confuse them?" And I said, "Oh yeah, let's not confuse them with the facts." Unfortunately, you know, that's my Einstein quote. You can't oversimplify it. Okay. Let me talk a little bit about fractions. Because of the blurring of I always do this when I talk. I lose my things. I can never go back to a previous slide because I just throw them all. Okay, because how do kids learn fractions? There are two ways to teach fractions in the elementary school. One is using things like regions where you take something and you say, I'm going to, say fold it. So there we have the continuous. So each of these is a half, and you can do quarters and so on. And unfortunately, the other one has to do with part of a set definition. I just looked a couple of weeks ago at my grandson's textbook because he had it home. And I'm pleased to see that at least the part of a set definition isn't the first one that's used. They first show them regions that are subdivided. Of course, you have to realize they don't show them. What they don't have as a good model, which is the model you really need for adding fractions, is the measurement model. Right? Kids who have done a lot of measurement, who know what a unit is, are prepared to learn how to add fractions. Kids who have learned only the part of a set model, let's say I'm making sets here, and I want to talk about the part of the set that's red. So if I put this out and it's the set, then a quarter of this set is red. Okay? Then let me make a third over here. So a third of this set is red. Now, and I can tell you, I've seen this happen in more than one. When I was doing the early childhood methods and the elementary school methods, the classes had a field experience. And those of us who were teaching there, at the University of Maryland, it was a team approach, and the students got all four of their methods classes in the same semester, and the members of the team would take turns visiting the school in which they were placed for their field experience on one day a week. And so I've seen this happen more than once. The kid says, okay, here's 1/4, here's 1/3, addition is joining, and what I have now for the sum is 2/7. Now, you know, it's perfectly logical. We even do that in many places, right? How do you compute a batting average? That's exactly what's done. I mean, this is a perfectly logical definition of addition, of fractions, if the fraction is a part of a set. Why don't we do that with fractions? Well, the reason we don't do it is because it wouldn't work if we were adding measures, right? Because then 1/2 + 1/2 would be 2/4, which is still 1/2. And we don't want that. So, you see, there's an arbitrariness in a certain sense. Why are we using the definition for adding fractions that we use? Because we want a definition that, I mean, first of all, I mean, we may want it for other reasons. We may want it for our mathematical structure that we're building here. But that's not something that kids are going to understand. What kids want to understand is we want to add fractions so it'll work in the most important situation where fractions first arose, which was in measurement. Now, I happen to own, I got this at the ICME meeting in Quebec. I went to hear a Japanese math educator, and he had published a methods book, which I bought. And I was very impressed with some of the things that I saw in that methods book. And one of the points he makes is, let's hold off presenting this this view of fractions until after they have learned to add fractions. And then he does a nice little example of a theorem we've all learned in mathematics and never used in geometry and not used very much. If the problem, you see, one reason I think they go for this is expediency. It's much easier to show the fraction as part of a set than to divide up units into, say, fifths or sevenths. I mean, you know, if you're dividing in halves or quarters, even thirds can be hard. He shows this illustration, and he says, take a piece of lined notebook paper and take your unit, and if you want to divide it into fifths, just turn it until it takes up 5 intervals. And then mark lines parallel to the margin, you know, to the ends of your paper. And you will have a nice model of fifths, and even young children can do that, or sevenths. And his advice is avoid the set definition of a fraction until after they've learned to add fractions, using only the part of a unit model. Okay? Then you want to introduce not only the part of a set, but the fact that a division, fraction can be interpreted as an indicated division. I mean, there are lots of interpretations for fractions. We want the children to learn the different interpretations for fractions. But when we want them to learn to add fractions, we want to give them some reason to do all that hard work of finding common denominators and only adding fractions with the same denominator. And they need to say why it needs to be done that way, not because the teacher says so or because the textbook says so. And so this, I think, is one of the most insidious things we do to kids. Now, I'm pleased to see that the newer elementary school textbooks are putting a lot more attention on the continuous model versus the discrete for fractions, but I still think they're introducing the part of the set model a little too early. Okay, let me see. I have 15 more minutes, and I should probably give you a chance to get to where you're going. So let me spend a little time. Oh, here's my learned disabilities. Okay, let me show you this page. I have a whole bunch of pages from this textbook, but I'm not going to have time to show you all of them. I have an algebra textbook that I picked up many years ago in a used bookstore that has a publication date of 1906. And it starts off in the introduction, by telling you that this is a clear presentation that everybody will be able to understand. Now, the good thing about, I don't know if you can really read this, I'll read you some of the, oh, thanks. The reason I brought this is because when I was teaching in the seventh grade, in the ninth, you know, in the middle school, I taught out of the Mary Dulciani textbooks. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with those textbooks in the, that were very popular in the 60s and early 70s. Mary Dulciani did the same thing that this guy is doing here. The development of the concept is done with a series of questions which she called oral exercises. The thing that I discovered, you see, and then you would lead the class through the oral exercises, and then you would come up with a conclusion. So you see, we start with unit number 42, and we have a series of 11 questions that is geared towards, let me put it over here, the next page where this guy is going is to get these principles in number 47. And the point that he's trying to make here is that let's change the sign and add, right? If you're subtracting, you can subtract using change the sign and add. And so this is how he develops it. Mary Dulciani did a very similar thing, and lots of books do that. Now, what's the problem with this? Well, the problem is that most teachers don't teach the oral, they don't do the oral exercises. That's problem number one. Problem number two, what happens to the kid who's absent on the day you do those oral exercises? The answers aren't provided. Kid takes the book home to their parent, and the parent is supposed to help them figure it out, and if the parent doesn't know enough mathematics, they don't know where it's going. So oral exercises are very difficult as a learning device for children if there is no supplement to get. And of course, most people don't care because all you want is the principles, right? And this goes on and on, to subtract when some terms are negative. So he's spending a lot of pages, you know, getting to the result. And a lot of it is, I mean, I don't know. You know, what's nice about this textbook, I haven't even brought those pages, is that he then does a lot of practical applications. The word problems are suitable for the early 1900s, okay? But I don't know that that this is very helpful for understanding, for example, that subtraction and addition are related, that subtraction is the inverse of addition, and that we want to subtract by change of sign and add, right? But then he further compounds the problem when he gets to fractions, because I know what my kids were confused about. Perhaps I should explain that when I taught, the first year I taught in the, well, all 3 years I taught in that school, I had all the accelerated kids. I had the seventh graders who were going to take algebra in the eighth grade. So these kids were identified as, by standardized testing, as being very capable, okay? But they really had generalized too soon incorrectly. I mean, I have to tell you one story about one kid who was in this class who's had obviously been drilled and drilled about mixed numbers. Now, first of all, let's look at mixed numbers. This is another place where we really confuse kids when it comes to starting to teach them algebra. Say we have 4.5. Well, we write the 4 beside the half, and the unwritten symbol is plus, right? Then they get to algebra, and if two things are written side by side, it's multiplication. But this kid had been further drilled in that no answer to a question involving fractions, in her head, it was obviously overkill, should ever be given as a improper fraction. Just think about the word, improper fraction. I mean, 7/3 is improper, and it should never be left as such. Of course, then later when they do more advanced algebra, all the mixed numbers have to be changed to improper fractions, right? But at this point, they were drilled that an improper fraction was improper, and you couldn't have it. And so one day I used to have my kids go to the board a lot, and one day she put something on the board, and she ended up with an answer like this, just because I have the 7/3 here. She got 3/7 for the answer, which was correct. And then she said, equals, 2 1/3. She, no fractions. She extended the no improper fractions to no fractions. So I said to her, tell me, is this number bigger than 1 or smaller than 1? And she said, it's smaller than 1. And I said, and is this number bigger than 1 or smaller than 1? And she said, it's bigger than 1. And I pointed to the equal sign, and I said, well, how can you say they're equal? And she looked at me as if I were crazy, and she said, because that's the way you do it. Well, I think there's there's a moral there. And I think that it's unfortunate that so many kids have already learned so much to disregard, we've separated them from their intuition. That's one of the things we've done. And I think that's what we have to be on the alert for at every stage in math education, is what meanings are these kids giving to what we're teaching them? Years and years ago, I read a paper by, I've forgotten the man's name, a very well-known science educator. And the title of the paper was Teaching by Listening. And his point was, if the child hears himself think out loud, they will self-correct. Constance Cammy in Early Childhood has a program like that where her teachers are not permitted to teach algorithms because she says to the teachers, what you have to make sure the kids understand is base 10. If the kids understand the base 10 aspect of our numbers, they will develop, most likely they're going to develop the same algorithms, but they might develop better ones. If you want them to develop shortcuts for calculations, for arithmetic calculations, they really need to understand what base 10 means. Now, let me stop for a minute and say something about that. Because the English language is very bad for teaching young children what base 10 means. I remember when one of my grandchildren, who's now 20, came to me, probably she was 3 or 4 at the time, because she was in my house, and she had been watching Sesame Street, or she was in the process of watching Sesame Street, and she came to me and she said, Grandma, why does a 12 have a 1 and a 2? And so I had to explain to her about grouping in tens and hold up the 10 fingers and so on. And of course, another time she asked me the same question. Now think about the number words. 11, if you go into the etymology of it, 11 means one left over. But unless you know that, you don't get the picture of base 10 from 11, nor from 12, which means 2 left over. And then you have 13, where we say the 3 first, and then the 10. Right, and all the teen numbers are like that. And then all of a sudden we go to 20, and now we turn it around. Right? We say the tens first, and then the 1. So the language that we're using for these number words does not help children to figure out the logic of our base 10 system. Now, I think one reason the international tests show the Oriental children doing so well in mathematics is because they have the history of the abacus. And in particular, the Japanese abacus, where they not only learn the combinations, the base 10 idea, but they also learn the combinations from 5 up to 10 that, they know that if you have 7, it's 2 more than 5, and it's 3 less than 10. They learn those by playing with the abacus, which is a toy, right, and for many children. So that's a real problem. I would be fascinated when I was at one of the years of my stay at my working at Simon Fraser University when Laszlo Babai came to teach the pre-calculus class. I unfortunately was only ever able to free myself up to attend a couple of his lectures. I would love to know what the Hungarians do in the elementary school. I was very impressed with what he did in the pre-calculus class because he spent a lot of time on the hard ideas. He didn't feel he had to say everything that was in the textbook. But he knew that he should spend his time on the hard ideas. And so he spent a lot of time on absolute value. He spent a lot of time on the things that give people trouble. And maybe I should close with the whole business of the root symbol. When we write, see, this is another example where we don't say what we mean. When you see this symbol, well, let me just put it How do we say it? What are the words we use? Square root of x. Do we say principal square root of x? No. And the people, the learners, beginning algebra people, do not learn that the square root of, well, how do I want to say it? That if x equals 9, that the square root of x, well, they know that if x equals 9, the square root of x, well, they don't pay attention to it. Plus or minus 3, right? But somehow it's all lost in the shuffle, and I think it's because we never use the word principal root here. We just say square root. And, of course, the kids have learned their negative numbers before they've learned, you know, it's all part of this, that this has to be negative. They never think that x is a negative number because they've done all that work with minus signs before they ever learned about negative numbers. And it's very, we don't pay enough attention to it. We don't spend the time, it's like Dr. Babai did. He spent the time in the class on the hard things. And then he gave them hard homework. And, of course, they had a place to go with their homework. They had our facility, which they called the workshop. And I found out the wonderful things that he was doing by the questions that the students came in with. And maybe I will close with one more story about a question who came into my lab, because this also has to do with all the way we say, the way kids feel, or the way many people feel, is that you're on dangerous ground when you go to numerical work with calculators. I had a student wander in there one day who wanted me to give him an analytic method for solving a cubic equation. He was wandering around, he had his cubic equation, and he wanted somebody to tell him what was the formula. You know, he knew that there was a quadratic formula, he wanted to know the formula for a cubic. And of course, it's many years since I had had my theory of equations course, and I couldn't remember the formula, it's a little complicated anyway. And so I advised him to go to the library and find an old book on theory of equations, and he would find his formula. But first, before I did that, I said to him, well, let's put in a couple of numbers. So he had a function, basically. He had an equation, a cubic third degree equation. And so I wrote it as a function, and we put in 1, and we put in 2. We put in 0 and 1 and 2. And, of course, it didn't take us 3 minutes to discover that there was a root between 1 and 2. So, you know, we had a calculator handy, and I put in 1.4 and, you know, put in a few with another decimal, and pretty quickly we knew there was a root between 1.5 and 1.6 or whatever. I don't remember the numbers anymore. And he had his coefficients had 2 digits, so I said, there, it's good enough. And he said, no, it isn't. I need the formula. So then before he left, I said to him, where'd you get this equation? Well, it turned out he was a physics student. It came out of measurements he made in a physics lab with 2 significant figures. But he wasn't willing to do numerical one. He had to have an analytic one. So there's another example of we're not connecting. Okay, well, I think I'll stop here. My time's up, and I hope that, I don't know if I've said anything useful, but anyway. Thank you.